In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Thank you for joining me today on the iSpy Radio Show. This week, it's about heroes. Real American heroes. And we need them. I have to admit, this week, I was feeling a bit depressed listening to the news about the continuing destruction of America by this administration, combined with the willing, apparently complicit Republicans who were elected in November to stop all this. Just this week, we heard that the Obama administration gave Iran the nuclear bomb, after candidate Obama mocked McCain back in 2008, saying Iran was now closer than ever to have a nuclear weapon. Now Obama's given it to them. You've got a sitting president stopping, via executive order, the lawful manufacture of bullets for AR-15s. Also breaking this week, the IRS emails from Lois Lerner have been recovered, after Obama's IRS chief lied and said that they'd been permanently destroyed. Has anyone gone to jail yet over this? It's just been one thing after another with this administration. Benghazi, fast and furious, the overthrow of American allies in Libya and Egypt, replacing them with the Muslim Brotherhood, and don't even get me started on Obamacare, the takeover not just of an industry, but of your mind and body as well. Where does all of this end? And this is why we need real American heroes, like Chris Kyle, people who are willing to put it all on the line for this country. That is what we need more than ever. And I'd like to welcome now Scott McEwen. He's the co-author of the phenomenally successful best-selling book, American Sniper, which, of course, has just been made, what not has just been made, but has been made into a movie directed by Clint Eastwood. Scott, it's great to talk to you today.
Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate coming back on with you guys.
Absolutely. You know, we love talking to you because your books really celebrate the true heroism and honor of the American military personnel. And we've got some exciting news that we want to make sure that we share with people later on about your Sniper Elite trilogy. And so people have to stick around for that. But we really want to talk about the Oscar night and how all of that went down. I know that that's really fresh on a lot of people's minds. And, you know, let's just kind of get your overall take on things. So what were you thinking during the Oscars? Because I'm sure you were probably watching them.
Yeah. Oh, yes, of course. You know, it's kind of funny because as you watch the Oscars and, you know, and the glitz and the glamour, all the fluff that is Hollywood, I was going through that show, I was thinking to myself, you know, I did not believe that that American Sniper was going to be seriously considered for the larger awards, you know, that were out there, because I always thought that, notwithstanding the fact that I felt Clint was very fair with the treatment of war in general with our movie, I just felt like they had issues with the whole subject matter. And, you know, and it proved to be true. And, you know, I haven't announced this publicly, but I'm going to say it on your show. I was disappointed with the win by Birdman, not because Birdman got the win per se over us. And it really is not that, but I felt that there were other things, particularly the movie on Stephen Hawking, where the guy got best actor. But that one, I would not have been that upset to have lost to. Because I really felt that was an amazing piece of work, and I felt that the performance by the lead actor in that was akin to Daniel Day-Lewis in My Left Foot. I just felt it was really, really well done. And the movie I felt was really well done and really a meaningful piece. But, you know, Birdman, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but I'm telling you right now, I was not impressed in the brief.
Yeah, I have not seen that one. I'm kind of in the same camp that you are. Is that I was not very impressed by the fact that it won, and largely because it was a movie that essentially looked at Hollywood itself and about the acting experience and all of that.
Right.
And so it was really more as kind of self-congratulatory than anything else.
I think that's a fair. I think it's a fair way of saying it. I might be a little bit more harsh than that, but yeah, you're right. Self-congratulatory, if not. You know, if not pandering to their own, it might be another term you could say, because it really was. And you know, and the ending, you know, I was almost offended. Maybe I'm just too stupid, but I just didn't get it. I didn't get it. You know, I guess I'm just not smart enough to understand how brilliant they are.
Well, you know, the fun thing about Oscars when they come out is that I get to hear about movies I'd never once heard about the entire rest of the year. And Birdman was certainly one of them. And there's a couple others in there, too, that have been nominated for one reason or another. And I'd never once heard of them. And, you know, here we've got American Sniper that has just done absolute gangbusters at the box office. And to have it kind of overlooked by that, by the Oscars. Yeah, it didn't come as a surprise, simply because I think my take on it really was that when I saw that movie, and we just saw it this week, when I saw that movie, I thought it was almost a little too real for Hollywood, which, you know, they want the fantasy. And I really feel that the movie is much bigger than the Oscars, because this really shows what these guys go through. And I just think that it really wasn't formulaic enough. They want that fantasy.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, and look, you know, at the end of the day, six nominations just shows that it did make waves even in their world. And, you know, and the fact of the matter is, I would much rather have not the money, but the appreciation that I have seen from so many people writing me, calling me, seeing reviews from military guys that are saying, you know what, you guys did it right. Thank you very much. People that knew Chris, including his wife and myself, who knew Chris very, very well, knowing how well that Bradley played Chris and how accurate his portrayal really was. I mean, those are the type of things that I would trade all of it, all these awards and everything else, just for knowing that people understood exactly how real that movie was. And that's important for me.
That really was cool. And with Bradley Cooper, I got to say, I'm really surprised that he did not win that. As far as Bradley Cooper is concerned, there was none of him on the screen. I mean, that was totally Chris Kyle. And that was just an amazing performance.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, and if that's what that to me is really, if you're going to make an award show, and I'm not saying the Academy Awards is that award show, but if you're going to make an award show that truly celebrates, you know, an acting profession, a job that's, you know, to put yourself 100% out there for that, then, you know, Bradley, as far as I'm concerned, should have got that award. And I know there's more awards and there's other things out there, but, you know, I don't know that that's what is celebrated at the Academy Awards. Yeah. I don't know that that type of performance is going to do it, because it's not something they want to see. It's not a person they want to see. It's not a character that they want to hear about, because it really, the character believes in this country and believes this country is a shining light on the hill. And that's what Chris Kyle was. And, you know, and when you have an audience there, not the audience that embraced this movie, but the audience at the Academy that really is not about that, then realistically, is there any way you can win with that type of character? And I would argue to you that probably is not.
Yeah. Ironically enough, that kind of character, that kind of Chris Kyle, is what makes the movies possible. You know, defending that, the right to free speech and defending all of America. I mean, it's really sad, really, that they cannot embrace characters like Chris Kyle. All right, let's go ahead and take a break right there. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more on American Sniper coming up after this. And we're talking today to Scott McEwen about the success of American Sniper, the movie. Scott was the co-author, along with Chris Kyle, of the book on which that is based. And later on, we'll be talking about his own trilogy of books, Sniper Elite, and some exciting news about that. So, of course, the big thing is whether or not it would win at the Oscars, but I'd like to actually talk about the film itself in this segment, because as I said in the last segment, was that, you know, we went to see it just very recently, so it'd be real fresh on my mind for this interview. And, you know, I got to say that I was a little surprised that it didn't get the nomination for Best Adaptation, because I thought it did a pretty good job of capturing the real spirit of American Sniper. What were your thoughts?
Yeah. You know, I think Jason did a heck of a job, and, you know, and I felt that he really, really distilled the book extremely well, and yet came out with a very strong message. I mean, there's just absolutely no way, you know, that you can take 2 hours and put in 400 pages. It's physically and time wise impossible to do it. But I felt that what between him and Clint Eastwood, that they both did an amazingly effective job of taking the overall view of what we were trying to do, and really explaining that to the audience in a very complete and thorough manner, in, you know, notwithstanding the limitation in time. And,
yeah,
you know, and I felt like he did a great job, and I felt like, you know, that Clint's work that he did with it as well was amazingly good. So, yeah, I mean, I felt like Jason was in that world, you know, and mm-hmm. I felt like he was, you know, deserving. And, you know, but once again, I mean, if you're not going to get it because of political reasons, and I maintain, look, I'm not doing sour grapes here. I'm really not. I mean, their world is their world. I was never trying to, nor was Clint trying to, nor was Jason trying to tailor our work to their world. But I'm telling you, you know, that world is very much focused on certain issues that they want to hear. And I think if you watch that award ceremony and see what they highlighted, all their social issues that they tried to, you know, cram down everyone's throats, you know, I felt like you really get a glimpse of their world. And if people watch that, they would understand a little bit more about where Hollywood comes from.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. In terms of adapting the book to the film, one of the advantages, you know, and books don't always easily transfer to the movie screen, simply because books are a different experience altogether. I mean, they allow for greater depth and insight into both the author's thoughts and the character's thoughts, and those can't always be easily captured through film. One advantage, though, that film does have over books is the ability to see what's occurring. So that way, if a reader doesn't have, say, military experience, and may not know what the equipment or armament is like, or what it's like to be immersed in these kinds of combat situations, the film really puts you there on the spot. And so I'm sure that you've talked with members of the military. What were their reactions to the missions in the film and how well they reflected or didn't reflect the reality of what they experienced?
Well, it's kind of funny because you get a lot of different views on that. And you know, because if you look at the reality of the time, the family, the communications with your family, the lack thereof, the miscommunications, all the things that were thrown in, you know, with the conversations and stuff. And I felt like a lot of military guys thought it was spot on, you know what I mean? But then you get to the more technical stuff about how a sniper sets up his hide, or how maybe, you know, you take a shot or whatever else. And then, you know, you kind of get some guys that, you know, particularly SEAL Team guys are like, well, you know, you kind of missed it here, Scott. And I said, you know, look, guys, you know, there's only so much we can do technically correct. I mean, because you guys are obviously the guys that trained them. So you're going to look for every single move that is wrong. So it's kind of funny that you got, you know, while I believe that the support was overall extremely healthy and very supportive, there was definitely technical issues that guys had issues with it. There was nothing I don't think we could do about that.
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny, actually, to hear their take on that. Oh, well, you know, we would have done it this way, or, you know, that's funny. You know, one of the more touching moments, I thought, in the film is when Chris loses a friend and he attends the military funeral, and he goes up to the coffin and he jams an insignia of some sort onto the lid of the coffin. Can you tell our audience a little bit more about that? What exactly is he doing there? And tell us more about that tradition, maybe where it comes from and what it signifies.
Yeah, that's called tacking it on. It's a ritual that is followed by the SEAL teams when they lose a comrade, that you go to their casket and you basically put your Budweiser, which is their SEAL Team badge, you know, the insignia for the SEAL Teams, the eagle with, you know, with the pistol and the trident, and you do what's called tacking it on. You tack it on his casket, you know, to send him on to the next world. But it's a pretty, I will say this, it's a pretty sobering thing to see, you know, in person. And I thought they did a pretty good job of it there, but, you know, they did a little bit at the end there, but I'm telling you, that one with Chris, when you saw that one, because there was like 200 SEALs there for that.
Yeah.
And it was a sobering experience. That's all I could say. You know, very, very, you know, touching to see that type of support from those guys, because, you know, and it's just something that, you know, they do. I mean, that's the way that they respect their fallen comrade, is to tack it on. And when you get your SEAL Team trident, generally it's not pinned on. A lot of people don't realize this. It's taken with the pin open and stuck in your chest. And then you tack it on there, too.
Mm. We're coming up on a break here. Let's go ahead and do that because we've got some pretty loaded questions here for you. And so everyone stay with us. Have more with author Scott McEwen. He was involved with the American Sniper film. He was involved with the American Sniper novel. And, of course, we're going to talk some more about that movie. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, and we're talking today to Scott McEwen. He's the co-author of the absolutely phenomenally successful best-selling book, American Sniper, which was made into a movie directed by Clint Eastwood, and of course it got snubbed by those Hollywood elites there in liberal land. But there's a saying that says the best success or the best revenge actually is a life well lived. And so I think your success at the box office just has to stick in their craw there. Yeah. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about the movie there, which I thought it did a pretty good job capturing the struggle really that Chris was going through. Professionally as a sniper, but also, just that human element of what he has to deal with and what he did and saw there in the Iraqi theater, as anyone would, they'd struggle with that. It was interesting though to see what was happening in his own life and how that was really impacting him. For example, there was this scene where there's this young boy, and Chris had just shot, this guy on the street who had a rocket launcher, and here's this like 10 or 11, maybe 12 year old young boy who picks up the rocket launcher, and, Chris is saying, don't pick it up, don't pick it up. And so he's having to hesitate, in that encounter there. And he just really looks to be emotionally breaking down. So in terms of, the book itself and how you knew Chris, was the reality of his own life at that point really started to intrude into his work as a sniper, especially after having his own kids?
Well, I think I'd have to answer that two different ways. The first way is to say that scene that's in there, if you look at that scene in the book where he does not shoot that kid at the end of that excursion, it was different. A little bit different than what's on there. And, I rarely took issue with the way that things were done, but this one was much more graphic than what it was put down in that scene. And, and Jason and I, let's just say we had differences of opinion on that scene. And the reason being is, that in that scene, I don't recall, but I could look back in my notes and in the book, obviously, but I think he shot 16 different guys before the kid came out to get that weapon. In other words, that street he was on for 8 hours, that's a high-value weapon. I think, a launcher of rockets such as that, an RPG, is a very high-value weapon amongst the enemy. And the enemy wanted that weapon back, and they had sent out multiple different people to try and retrieve that weapon. And Chris was back about 1,000 yards. And that's a long distance from that weapon.
Sure.
And after he first got them, there was like a huge, that was like inside of a huge group of military guys running that area. So he couldn't leave, and they kept on trying to retrieve the weapon, and Chris kept on shooting. And I believe he had 16 confirmed kills on that gun before they sent the kid out. Now, when they sent the kid out, it would have been much different in my mind, because by the end of it, Chris was so emotionally taxed, he was like, you've got to be kidding me. To be kidding me. Like, I've got to do this too. Enough is enough. And that was a point when Chris said, you know what? Take your damn RPG. And you know what? I will give you this one back, because I am not going to, they obviously forced the kid to go out and get it. And he said, I'm not going to shoot this kid in this circumstance, even though, it's probably what I should have done. I just was not willing to do it. Now, it showed, an emotional turn on that weapon, which there had to be a point in time when you had to show that character change, but I think that was a little bit more graphic than what was depicted in the movie, because that was a crazy day in human life. And Chris was literally running down in ammunition because of the number of people that he'd had to incur, do battle with that day.
Well, to me, I mean, that's really interesting, and I love this kind of behind-the-scenes look at the different takes on how you would portray that, because to me, doing it like it happened in the book and like it happened in real life, That is much more poignant than what they showed in the movie. I mean, because it was kind of almost happenstance the way that it was projected there in the movie. And it also really shows the depth of evil. I would think to be sending a kid out there. I mean, the opening scene itself is an awesome portrayal of the depth of evil, really, and the total disregard for human life when they're willing when they're willing to send kids out into a war zone to handle these weapons and whatnot. And so I'm curious why Jason didn't think it was more powerful to do it the way that it actually happened. What was his reasons that he gave you?
Well, you know, the carnage that was shown was graphic in and of itself.
Sure.
But there was a feeling, that if it got too graphic, that people would almost desensitize to what the overall message was. And, you know, when you're dealing with somebody that's got the number one, you know, most successful sniper in U.S. military history, there's a lot of graphic scene, you know?
Sure.
So, you know, I think that maybe there was a decision made at certain levels that possibly if we pushed it too far, that we would turn off certain groups in the audience, that maybe it wasn't fair, even though it maybe didn't depict as much as what it could have.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, you know, I leave those decisions, you know, to people that have shot Flags of Our Fathers, Letters from Iwo Jima. You know, these guys have been around, including Clint Eastwood, and I'm not saying Clint made the decisions there, but there was decisions made to not go as graphic as what it possibly was for reasons of keeping the audience, you know, invested in the movie. And, you know, I wasn't part of some of those, but I was, you know, as a consultant, but I certainly was not a part of a lot of those. And so, you know, that's beyond my pay grade, if you will.
Wow. Interesting discussion. And anyway, we are coming up on a break here, so let's go ahead and do that. Coming up, we'll have more on the book and the film, American Sniper, with the guy who'd know, Scott McEwen. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson. We are talking today to Scott McEwen. He's the co-author of American Sniper, and we've been talking about the film and really some interesting insights into how all that was played out. And so going into the break there, we were talking about one of the scenes there in the film and really the essence of evil, I think, that was being portrayed there in the film. And I got to say, that's one area where I would have liked to have seen drawn out more was Chris's conviction that they were really facing real evil. And we see some of the barbarity, and we already talked about the one scene, but also there are several other scenes there, so you saw the barbarity that was occurring with the insurgents, and now what we see with ISIS, and you know, here you've got Obama thinking that a job program would somehow make these people less evil. What did Chris come away with after seeing all of the barbarity there? Did it deepen his convictions about the fact that this is a fight between good and evil, or did he get a chance to get to know these people more? I mean, what would you say were his thoughts coming out of that, and also what are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, I think that Chris educated me in many ways, because I did not understand really a lot of the dynamics of what was going on and what is going on today over there. And, you know, and one of the things that people have tried to, particularly the left, have tried to characterize Chris's saying was that he wanted to take care out all the people over there, as opposed to those that are involved in this terrorist, this takeover, this whole, you know, Islamic fundamentalist movement that the president's unwilling to describe as such, but, you know, that are doing bad things to their own people. Hmm. I mean, the bottom line is that it's not just us that this people is fighting or was fighting. They're taking their own people out and killing en masse those that have differences of opinion as we speak. You know, this is not in the past tense. This is in the present tense. And so the world has had a glimpse of it recently with some of these people that they, you know, they lined up 25 of them, and, you know, cut their heads off on the beach and, you know, in Libya. But let me tell you something. The guys that have been over there and seen it experienced it.
Hmm.
But Chris's, I think, view was not that they were all bad at all. His view was that the ones that they were after that were really trying to cause the chaos so that there would be no democratic elections, there would be no ability of the people of Iraq to speak, if you will, in a rational, civil manner. That's the evil he was fighting. That's the evil of the torturers, the people like that. That's what he was after. Those were the savages that he described and we described in the book. So, you know, you can't take it all and put it together. There's an Islamic fundamentalist movement, such as we see now with ISIS, Al-Qaeda, you know, Al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula, etc., that will kill anyone with a different ideology than theirs. There, here, at the World Trade Centers, anywhere else. That is what Chris Kyle and our troops were fighting. That is the evil that Chris was describing. That is what we were talking about. Now, you know, that was not an overall view of all the people there. And I want to make it very clear to the people that that's what the left wants you to say. Therefore, you should dislike Chris Kyle types because they were all trying to take out all these people. That's incorrect. We were trying to, what the troops were trying to do was give these people the ability to make a decision on their own without having a 10% fundamentalist movement kill those who would otherwise go out and vote. And, you know, and that's the real loss that we have now when we just wholesale pulled out of that country, created a vacuum, and have this mess that was created as a result thereof because of the naivety of this administration believing that you can go kumbaya and hold hands with them or give them a job at 7-Eleven and then they won't be doing this head cut. Let me tell you something. That ain't the way it is. And these guys are so simplistic in what they've done. You know, it's embarrassing to this country, in my opinion.
Well, you know, you just can't fight a black and white worldview like they have, like some of these fundamentalists have, with squishiness. I mean, you have to have a strength of resolve, and we're not seeing that, unfortunately, with this administration. I mean, I've just, you know, knowing that this interview was coming up, and I've been looking at some of the news and whatnot in terms of Iraq and Iran, and you know, here just a couple of days ago, the news broke that they've essentially given away the ability for Iran to have a nuclear bomb, for heaven's sakes. I mean, and you look at that, and you look at that in combination with this idea that we have a jobs program for ISIS, and suddenly they'll all start loving us. I mean, it's approaching the level of treason, quite frankly. I mean, I don't know how else to look at it. I mean, this is how he is just selling us down the river to these people that he thinks are going to love us if we apologize enough.
And, you know, and you'd think at this stage, you would think even this group, who I consider to be, you know, of average intelligence, maybe they have a different worldview than I do, but I still am not willing to say that those degrees that they all got from the Ivy League makes them stupid, okay? But I will say this, that you would think that they would learn, at least by now, that their points were at least ignorance, that they really did not understand the world the way it works.
Yeah.
But they continue to amaze me even now. They continue to amaze me day after day, you know, with their lack of understanding of what it is, even though they get slapped in the face and, you know, kicked around like dogs, you know, and all the time. I mean, these apologists, I mean, do they think that these guys over there really give a darn, and I use the term, you know, weekly there, about what they think? And look, man, this is about power, and it's about control of others. And like it or not, if you don't bring power to the table in dealing with what they're doing, then they will dismiss you as a punk. And that's exactly what's going on.
Absolutely. And, you know, I agree with you. These Ivy League degrees may not necessarily make them stupid, but it certainly seems to certify them that way. But, you know, when it comes to Iran, I just don't get them. I mean, are they so isolated that they don't even bother to pick up the newspaper? I mean, it was on Drudge Report today that how Iran is now, they're doing these bombing runs on a replica of a U.S.-American aircraft carrier. And
that seems peaceful to me, doesn't it, you?
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, what will it take to wake these people up? All right, let's go ahead and take a break right here. We'll have more with author Scott McEwen coming up right after this.
Think of it as actionable intelligence, the iSpy Radio Show.
And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, talking today to Scott McEwen, co-author of American Sniper. And we've been talking about the film and also some of the experiences there that Chris Kyle went through. And, you know, a couple of things that I want to talk about before we leave the discussion of the movie. There was a really interesting scene, I thought. in the psychologist's office. This is after he's come back from his tour of duties, four tour of duties. And the psychologist is making this assumption that he's suffering from guilt over the kills. And instead, Chris says, that's not me. I'm ready to answer to God for every shot I took. And so, obviously, he was definitely struggling with everything that he was going through. But it's really almost, in a way, surprising that he wasn't struggling even more than he was. What do you suppose it was that was about him that he was not more affected than he actually was?
You know, I saw, and I've talked to Chris about this many times, and I saw an interview where a reporter from Time magazine was trying to catch Chris out by the numbers, and you know, and Chris looked at her, and that's about the same statement as made to the psychologist during that thing, that what bothered Chris was not the shots he took and the bad guys he shot with that. What bothered him was the guys that he did not take out that ultimately came and killed Americans or blew up Americans or whatever else, his guys that he saw when his guys got shot or killed. That's what haunted Chris, was the fact that he couldn't take and protect all his guys. And it's a weird phenomenon with the guy. It really struck me when I was talking to him that was his job, was to really try and take as many of the bad guys out before they got to our guys. And he was not always successful at doing that. Now, you know, that was possibly part of what that pregnant question, if you will, from that psychologist and response was, you know, but really that's what taunted Chris, was, you know, the guys he could not save. And I believe that, you know, I don't think he slept bad a single time knowing when he was taking out bad guys. Maybe, you know, kids that were put up to it. Yeah. Okay. You know, that was more difficult for him, but the bad guys themselves, you know, which were 99% of the shots, that didn't bother him.
You know, if there was a time in terms of it really bothering him that there were the shots that he didn't make, do you know if there was a time where he could tie a missed shot to somebody on his team that got killed?
No, I don't know that it was a tie and a missed shot to a guy on his team, but I do know one time a Marine that he was running and kicking indoors with in Fallujah, he got shot and took a wound to the abdomen, stomach area, and died on top of Chris, flat out on top of him. And wow. I know that really bothered him. That really bothered him that he couldn't save that kid. And the kid died literally on top of him in a firefight where he couldn't get him out, and the medics couldn't come in because they were right in the middle of a really bad firefight. And that one bothered him. There's no doubt about it. I know that one bothered him. And, you know, so, I mean, that definitely took a toll on him mentally. And, you know, we talked about it in the book some, but, you know, I didn't tie it directly, that shot, to anything that he missed or anything like that. But, you know, overall, he felt like he was very good at what he did and that his teammates were very good at what they did. And these guys had become war. And a lot of these kids that were coming out of Camp Pendleton, not that I'm downgrading or talking bad about the Marines, they're, neither did Chris. They're a heck of a fighting force, and they're very, very, you know, patriotic and do exactly what they're told to do. And they're in amazing shape and amazing shots. But, you know, go to boot camp or to you know, basic for 3 months. That's different than when you have lived war for 10 years, like Chris and his teammates had done. They were professional warriors. They knew every trick that the enemy could throw at them, and they knew every trick that they could throw back at the enemy, and they were very effective at what they were doing.
Well, in terms of that psychologist, and I don't know how this played out in real life, but in terms what I did like that psychologist did was he immediately recognized that what Chris needed to heal was for him to help heal others. And so for the non-military people that are listening, what is the average vet, when they're coming back from a situation like that, what does the average vet need in terms of support from people? Is it just someone to listen to, or do they really need another vet to be around and to hang with so that way that, you know, they've got that camaraderie?
I think it's a combination of both. And I would suggest that, you know, that many times the camaraderie between the vets, because they've been through the same thing, they don't have people going, ooh, ah, you know, like, oh, wow, you know, are you okay? That kind of stuff. They don't want that. You know, they don't want that reaction, if you will. What they want is just somebody to talk about that has been there and done that. So I think that really helps them out to have those type of discussions. But also, you know, on an average person basis, you know, or the average civilian, such as myself or you or any of the other people that maybe have not experienced this, I find that just the recognition of listening is a lot to these guys and hearing what they've done. And, you know, and they don't want you to step out or something like that, but thank you for your service when you're sincere about it. I think that that really means a lot to them, you know, and I think that just something like mowing the lawn of some guy because he's out of town and maybe his wife needs some help, or, you know, maybe changing the oil in their car or something small like that that can help a family, really means a lot to those guys that are deployed. And, yeah, you know, and I think each of us can do big things in very small ways.
Yeah. Well, you know, Chris lost his life as a result of trying to help another vet. And now that trial is over and he was found guilty, is there anything that you'd like to comment on in terms of the trial?
Well, the one thing I would comment on is this, you know, and I've said it from day one. That guy had issues mentally. There's no doubt in my mind. But I always thought that he had the ability to understand the difference between right and wrong. And you go through the prison system anywhere in the world, I'll guarantee you're going to find a lot of people that they have issues mentally. Now, that's not saying that there's not a situation where you're not going to have a person that has totally lost their sanity and maybe has no ability to understand the difference between right and wrong. But that wasn't this guy. And, you know, and he stole my friend's car, and he said he traded his soul for stealing his car. And he killed my friend, and he killed Chad Littlefield. And, you know, I felt it was a disservice to the people and the men and women of the military that truly have PTS issues, post-traumatic stress, to let this guy get off on that, because I never thought that was the case here. The guy never was outside the wire. He was a dirtbag before he went in the military. Apparently he was a dirtbag while in the military, and he was certainly a dirtbag after he got out of the military.
Yeah.
And I don't know of any single circumstance where he was outside the wire, really was in combat per se. Not that he didn't witness certain things possibly while he was there, but he did not go through the things of the guys that I've seen that truly do have some things they got to work through. Number two, you do not see these guys that are having these problems turn the gun on others. They may turn the gun on themselves and they may commit suicide, but it is not common, nor is it even seen, you know, virtually ever that they go, you know, on other people. And I think it would be a disservice to what Chris stood for and for the members of our military, for the public in general, to think that that's what took place here. It did not. Yeah. And I'm thankful that the people in Texas saw that that was the way it was.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. We're running a little bit long, so let's take a break right here. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more and wrap things up with Scott McEwen. Stay with us. And thanks for staying with us. We are into our last segment now with Scott McEwen, co-author of American Sniper and also author of his own trilogy of books, Sniper Elite Series. And speaking of which, Variety just released a few days ago that Target America from the Sniper Elite Trilogy series is being developed by Sony Pictures. They announced that, I'm going to butcher his name, Wame Koyesera. I'm not sure how you say that.
Yeah, Jaume Koyesera.
Okay, and anyway, he's going to direct, and he just came off of three films with Liam Neeson, all action flicks, and it's being adapted for the screen by Sheldon Turner, who was the writer for X-Men First Class, I believe, which I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed that one. So you got a great team here. So absolutely congratulations on this. This was certainly well-deserved.
Yeah, I mean, I was real pleased with the way it worked out too. And, you know, Mike DeLuca, who's now president at Sony, was really excited about the whole project. I've known Mike for some time. He was interested previously in the American Sniper and didn't end up doing the project. And I think he has the belief now after the success of American Sniper. And, you know, when I brought this project in there with the other guys with the team to make this, you know, this rendition of both book one and two. They've actually purchased both.
Oh, they have? Okay, good.
And Target America. They jumped at it, and Sony's backing it, and they intend to make the replacement for James Bond, which I understand that their James Bond series, they're about to lose that from Sony's perspective, or at least they will no longer have a deal for that. And so he has the vision that he wants to make this the next, if you will, James Bond.
Oh, how awesome is that? Boy, that's just got to give you chills almost.
Yeah, that could be a huge franchise. I mean, you know, if you think about it, that could be full writing, if you will, opportunity for a number of years.
Oh, that is terrific. Now, okay, so you've got these books, and again, if people have not read these books, they absolutely need to. These are fun, action-packed, just thrilling novels, just from the word go. My producer, when she picked up your first book there, she read the whole thing in one day. Just was absolutely riveted to that story. So this is really exciting. And in terms of actually adapting it for the screen, though, are you, since you were the actual author of this one, are you going to be able to work with the screenplay writer very much on this?
Yeah, no, Sheldon and I made a decision, and I agreed that Sheldon was going to be the guy after we talked about it in some detail. We're going to try and make it as close to the reality of both the book as well as the reality of what these guys go through as we can. I mean, we're really, you know, we got a consulting team that's going to be working with me, and we're going to be directly working with retired Navy SEALs and with guys that are, you know, have been at war for 10 years, just to make it authentic, as authentic as possible, with the skill set, with the shooting set, with the, you know, everything that goes into them being, you know, the best fighting force on earth. And it's important to us that we make this as real as we can. And, you know, and that's really, we feel that if we do that and make it real, that the people will understand that we've done it. And it's kind of like what we did with American Sniper, except for we're going to get even a little bit more down in the dirt, if you will.
How exciting. I mean, you just got to be absolutely thrilled. This is really the chance of a lifetime, and it is so cool to see this unfold. It's very well deserved. In the time that we've got remaining here, we talked about this in one of the previous segments about the Obama administration in response to the evil that we're seeing by these Islamic fundamentalists. And, you know, the military has really been struggling in the last year or two with these budget cuts that have been happening. And just recently, the Heritage Foundation released a report called 2015 Index of U.S. Military Strength. And this basically says that we no longer have the ability to fight two wars. And that has been a standard of American military readiness going back, really, to the Roosevelt administration. So what are you hearing from people that are in the military still? What is their take in terms of what they are seeing happening to the military?
You know, I think there's a lot of distress, particularly from the command level. I mean, I see a lot of guys that are officers that, you know, that really care about this country, that have been with the military for a number of years and seen it, the ebbs and flows through different administrations. But I really believe that they feel that this administration is particularly unfair in their understanding of what the mission of the military is and how they're going to accomplish it. And I think that politics enter too much into decision-making here, you know, relative to what this military has got to do and what they accomplish. And I just don't get it. I mean, we've seen the rules of engagement degrade now to the point where we've got guys like Clint Lawrence, and, you know, I want to put a plug in here right now, freeclintlawrence.com. You know, we've got an officer that's being prosecuted that's doing 20 years in Leavenworth for making a decision to order his men to take shots to engage an enemy that's approaching their position. And he gets 20 years in Leavenworth for that. And basically, you know, just says, look, protect yourselves. And that's really what's degrading this military attitude, too, because they're not getting the backing that they need to have from the Pentagon, from the people that are making the decisions on rules of engagement, and from this administration. So we're sending men out to do the work, but we're tying one hand behind their back and basically putting their gun on safety, and they can't take it off safety even when they're being shot at.
Yeah.
So it's just crazy.
It is crazy, and I would have used the word hostile, actually, in terms of this administration's response to the military. Scott, I want to thank you so much for your time today, and always a pleasure talking with you, and congratulations again on the movie deal.
Thank you guys for having me on. You know, I really appreciate it, and you know, you guys always have me on and really support our projects really closely before it was anything big. And, you know, now that it's big, I really appreciate not only what you do for me, but what you do for putting the word out there for the men and women of our troops.
Well, thank you. That's very kind.
Yep. We'll talk to you guys later.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you for joining us today. I hope this lifted your spirits as much as it did mine. It is really exciting to hear about Scott's Sniper Elite trilogy making it onto the big screen. His third book will be coming out this May, so lots of time still to get caught up. And what an honor for him that his books and movies may be inspiring the next generation of American heroes. Maybe even the next Chris Kyle. If you're active or former military, thank you for your service. We'll get this country back on track, although like any trauma, I know it's going to take some time to heal. and it's going to take a lot of work. Because, like we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.